I forgot one natter, by the way, during nattering.
Natter away.
At this Sunday at 11 p.m., Harlan Ellison's Twilight Zone airs his new one, Crazy as a Soup Sandwich.
Crazy like a soup sandwich
as
or
a soup
crazy
sandwich.
As a soup sandwich?
As.
Harlan Ellison.
Yes.
He's the guy who does the car commercials.
Yeah. Noted futurist. In the studio with us now, in the course of the, I guess it's 2 years now we've been doing Hour 25, which is a pretty frightening thought, by the way.
Yeah, it seems much longer.
For on both ends of the mic, I would think, as a matter of fact. We have had a number of guests come through these studios, and the two who have given us the greatest interviews and the greatest reactions to those interviews have been Norman Corwin and Ray Bradbury. So it seems only fitting that to reward the group mind for staying with us and to just get a bit of radio history in the process, bring back these two wonderful guests on our show together again for the first time. Now, is this the first time you've been together on a show, or is this
on a radio show? I think have we done a radio show before?
I don't think so.
No, we've done personal appearances. You know, women's clubs. I mean, birthday parties. You name it.
Bar mitzvahs.
Yeah.
Now you guys go back 42 years. Is that correct?
That's right.
How did you first meet? What was the
circumstances? Well, I was responsible. I fell in love with Norman's work on radio in 1939 and followed it all through the war and to the end of the war and looked forward to every week when he had his weekly show and went to the library and read his books and thought, geez, boy, if I could ever meet him someday, it would be wonderful. So when my first book came out in the summer of 1947, I sent a copy to Norman. I found out his address through CBS, some secretary lady there, and wrote a note to him saying, if you like this book as much as I love you and your radio shows, call me and I'd like to buy you a drink some afternoon. And about a week later, he called me and said, you're not buying me drinks, I'm buying you dinner. And after that dinner, we became friends forever. So it's beautiful.
So, Norman, what was your reaction to getting this book for the first time?
Well, you know, it's not very difficult to recognize a talent. This talent was all over this book and every page of it. It was a very exciting book. And I was delighted to get it and to meet this new artist. And then when I got to the coast, we met in New York first, didn't we, Ray?
No, you invited me to dinner somewhere on Sunset Boulevard. You were out here
but
then.
But we did meet in New York.
Yeah, he's responsible for, this gets very complicated here, but after we'd known each other a couple of years, Norman kept nagging me, saying, you've got to come to New York because you haven't met the editors, and Katie, my wife, and I are going to be in New York in June. Why don't you come? And we'll take you around New York. We'll introduce you to a few people. And we'll make sure you're not lonely, because I didn't know that many people in New York. So I saved my money. My wife was pregnant. We had no money. We had $40 in the bank. Took the Greyhound bus to New York with all my manuscripts in a big box. And met Norman there. And they took me to cartoon festivals and plays and what have you. But along the way, I met the editors of Doubleday, and they said, what have you got? I said, 500 short stories. They said, no, we don't publish short stories. Don't you have a novel? I said, no, I'm not a novelist. They said, well, this one editor was smart enough one evening to say, what about all those Martian stories of yours? Wouldn't they tie together and make a novel? And I said, gosh, you know, I thought of that years ago and forgot about it. So they said, go back to the YMCA tonight, write us out an outline. If we like it, we'll give you $500 tomorrow. You'll be rich. And I went back to the YMCA and sat up all night and wrote the Martian Chronicles outline and took it in the next day, and they gave me $500, which was enough money to keep me for a year. And 42 years ago.
A lot of money then.
And but if Norman hadn't, you see, what I'm saying here is if Norman hadn't egged me on, I would never have made the trip, and the Martian Chronicles wouldn't have been written, or it would have been written years later.
How old was Ray at 19?
At 27. 27,
pardon.
Ray was at 27 the way Ray is now at 47. Ray was brilliant, he was alive, Ray is the only writer I know who thinks in essay form and who speaks poetry spontaneously. His images are that vivid and that alive. And
speaks in italics, I've noticed.
Spontaneous. Pardon?
Speaks in italics, too.
Well, people want to drown me all the time.
And Ray was a very exciting young man. As a matter of fact, I recall very vividly meeting Ray on his home turf when I got out here. Mm-hmm. He was living in very modest digs with Maggie in Venice. And I went out to Venice one evening for a dinner. Mm-hmm. And Ray, I fancied myself a music connoisseur and knew a lot about music, knew everything about music, except that I didn't know the Brahms Alto Rhapsody. And Ray, after dinner, said, I want you to hear a recording of the Brahms Alto Rhapsody with Marian Anderson.
That's right.
Ray put it on. So, though, you know, everything about this man, his circumstances, his talent, his home, was memorable. It's indelible. That's 42 years ago.
Yeah. Must be extraordinary for you, the Ray. My Norman Corwin story. When I was taking classes at San Diego State University, I signed up for a class in writing workshop. And I saw the instructor's name, Norman Corwin, which rang a bell. And someone said, I think it's in Who's Who. So I went to the library to find Who's Who, and I saw his name at the top of the page and began reading down the page and down the page and down the page and turned the page and kept reading on the other side. And the first day of class, I was so thunderstruck to be in the same company as this individual in the front of the room that for 7 years I called him Mr. Corwin thereafter.
Sure, yes.
Until he gave me permission to call him otherwise. At 27, was the experience knowing who Norman was?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you're out of your head. And I, well, you know, when you're, we all, we men, women too, I suppose, but I can't answer for them. We men, I suppose, are much more hero-oriented than women are by our very nature. And these heroes stand across our lives, and we look up to them, and we say, my God, you know, if I could finally meet them, that would be fantastic. And then one of the great thrills of my life is when I went to New York summer of 49. Norman was busy doing a series of United Nations broadcasts, one-hour shows, and I was privileged to sit in the sound booth with him and watch him direct the actors and put the tape together. It was the advent of adding voices via tape, and it was a whole new technique being developed, mainly by Norman at the time, actually. Mm-hmm. And to just sit there and bathe, huh? Drown all day, in elation, you know, and with fits. I had to go to the men's room and cry quietly. I was so happy, huh? And so, boy, we don't realize, I suppose this happens to all of us at some time or another, that by example, how we're changing other people's lives. And then automatically you've got to live up to your hero. So my very first radio show that same year was for the one of the big international movement, United Nations things, and I wrote a radio drama, which was pure Norman Corwin, absolutely, mm-hmm. because I didn't know how to write a radio drama, so I imitated my hero. Mm-hmm. But the first person I called when the show was over was Norman to check it out with him and see if it was okay. And then when I got the job of writing Moby Dick for the screen when I was 33, the next day, the first person I called was Norman, because I wanted to find out what Mel Herman Melville was all about. And I knew that Norman might know, because I sure didn't know.
One can hear Norman in your voice and in your writing every so often. The word pictures that come across and the very specific images that Norman definitely used in all of his work.
Well, he was always brave and took chances. And that's what you leap off the cliff with a metaphor and hope you make it to the ground without breaking all your bones, huh? Mm-hmm. And Norman has always done that. And you don't play it safe. You don't ask people's opinions. You just go do it. And then the good stuff comes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's terrific. Sometimes it's just all right. But mm-hmm. your chances are better that way than the safe way of people thinking about things mm-hmm. and never doing them.
Well, I feel thank you, Ray. You've been very generous, and so have you, Joe. I think Ray roared past me on the fast track of imagination, and his stories just are so vital and alive with metaphor and with the adventure of the mind. Mm-hmm. Ray exercises the musculature of poetry at all times. And Ray speaks about heroes. We all have our heroes. We are made by our antecedents. I know what Ray is kind enough to say I was to him, the
preceding writers were to me. I was enriched by, and in fact, intoxicated by, the writing of Sandburg, and before him of Whitman, and then of course back to Shakespeare and to Keats and to all those wonderful romantics, and I read them and enjoyed them before I knew what they meant really. Mm-hmm. I didn't dig everything they were saying, but I knew that it was luxuriant, mm-hmm. and this was great music. Mm-hmm. And indeed, when we listen to music, which is the ultimate abstraction in sound, we don't profess to understand what Beethoven is saying in the Eroica, or what Mahler is saying in his first symphony. Understanding is not a part of it. It's the enrichment through art that speaks to the heart. Mm-hmm.
You both, before I get into that, you mentioned there was you had dinner with Carl Sandburg on one occasion, and he had poems in his pocket.
Oh, yeah. I had the great privilege of being a host to Sandburg for a whole month once when he's out here in California. I was living then in Sherman Oaks and had a guest house, and that became Carl's. And he would rise at noon every day, and you'd come in for breakfast. And at one time, he was searching in his pocket for something, and to find it, he emptied his pockets of scraps of paper, and some of them were crumbling with age. And he had written in pencil little slivers of poems, and he laid them out on the table as you would take pocket change and lay it out. And I said, "May I read some of those?" And he said, "Sure." And they were little gems. Mm. And I said, "Carl, these are wonderful. But how these look pretty old. How long have you had them?" He said, "Well, some of them are 10 years old, 12 maybe." I said, "Why haven't you published them?" He said, "Well, I'm not through with them yet." But that, each man has his style. I fancy, Ray may correct me on this, but my impression of Ray is that of absolutely an unbroken succession of triumphs of discipline. Mm. Ray is prolific. At dinner tonight, Ray put into my hands, I hold in my hands. I'm looking at, it's a new book, the Toynbee Convector, and there I'm counting the stories listed in front. It says, also by Ray Bradbury. 3, 6, 9, 12. Well, you can tell me.
Roughly 23.
23 books. Yeah. How about that? Mm-hmm. A young man. He's still a young man.
Well, it's not Isaac Asimov, though. 300 books from Asimov.
Well, listen, I'll take these 23 against Asimov. And, he's the essence of a poet. I once had the privilege of directing a script by Ray about Thomas Wolfe, Reclaimed from the Dead. Mm-hmm. Marvelous story. What's the name of that?
Forever in the Earth.
Tell you. And this may sound extremely bizarre, but in this story, Thomas Wolfe goes off to Mars in a rocket. And it's a tremendous story. Yet, in spite of that, Ray is on very good terms with the machine. One of his books is called The Haunted Computer, uh-huh. and The Android Pope. And then he has The Machineries of Joy. Uh-huh. That's a nice title. The Machineries of Joy. And here we have the Toynbee Convector. I'm not sure I know what a convector is, but there it is.
It sounds good.
It sounds great.
Well, the operative word here, you're talking about discipline. Love is discipline, you see, and that's true for both of us. That if you discipline yourself just for discipline's sake, forget it. You're not going to do good work. But if love drives you to your work, if love is the discipline, then you're going to do great stuff. You know, you can't stop, huh? And it has its own parameters.
Excuse me, Ray. Yeah. Continue.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that with writers, with most writers, and I think I'm one of them, it's a love-hate relationship. You hate the hard work. I'm a revisionist, and I go over and over these things. And sometimes I have the I'm elated. I think I'm that's it's coming at last. And I put down a phrase, and I think that is really first class. And I'm so excited, I have to take a walk around the block to wear it off. And then the next day I pick it up and think, what was I excited about? You know, it's worn off. And I like Sandberg, except in shorter term. I say I'm not through with it yet.
Mm-hmm. Well,
are you ever satisfied with it? Is it ever completely what you want it to be?
I think that I have not yet reached Ray's mark, although I've had, I guess I have 17 titles between covers of one form or another. And I think that perhaps with the exception of the briefest of those, there's not one that I had not wished I had back again to work on.
How about you, Ray?
Oh, well, I'm one of God's... I said earlier in the evening, God breathes on my neck and I sneeze. And that's really it. I never question my work. I don't revise. It's got to come right or I leave, you know. If it isn't instantly joyful and full of fun, then I won't bother with it. And I treat ideas like cats. See, you must turn your back on an idea and walk away from it. Make it follow you. Huh? You must be in control of the explosion, and you must never know what you're doing. And therefore, then it happens, and then you look at it. And sure, I trim down, but if you treat life as an explosion of joy and surprise, huh? Mm-hmm. All this stuff that's in you that you don't realize is there, then you have a hell of a lot more fun. If I have to worry over a thing. When I write a novel, I never read it, huh? So I spend a whole year writing a thing I don't know anything about, huh? And that way it remains mysterious. I was in Italy 10 years ago, and I met Federico Fellini for the first time and loved his work as madly as we all do. Even the bad stuff is wonderful. And so at dinner one night I said, is it true that when you're making a film, you never look at it? And he said, that's right. I said, that's very interesting. How come? He says, because I want to remain a mystery. Mm. If I look at the rushes every day, I get to know it too well, and that stops your creativity. If I refuse to look at it, then I say to myself, I wonder what I did yesterday. I wonder what I did last week. And that provokes you, huh? Mm-hmm. It's like any love affair. You don't want... See, that's what's wrong with a lot of biographies and autobiographies today. They tell you too much. I don't want to know about your life. Don't tell me. Come on, cut it out. Huh? Mm-hmm. I don't want to know your sex life. I don't want to know your dreadful friends. It's a bore. Huh? But tell me how you get ideas and what you do with them, what you get them. That's the great stuff, huh? The surprises. Mm-hmm. So Fellini was verifying my own behavior. I said, thank God there's someone else like myself in the world, mm-hmm. that I don't reread my material. I don't look at it. If I have to, I put it away for months. So that I begin to wonder, geez, what's that old love like, huh? And then you go back and meet the old love. And if it looks okay, you just brush her up a little, huh? Put some powder on her nose, and send her out into the market, where she then falls on her face. But that's okay. But writing must be mysterious. It must be a surprise. And it must be fun. If it stops being that, my TV people came to me 4 months ago, and they said, we want to do 40 more shows. I said, no, you don't. They said, what do you mean? The show's successful. We've done 18. I said, yeah, but you don't want to do 40. They said, yes, we do. I said, no, you want to do 12. And they said, how come? I said, because you want me to work for you, and I won't. I'll play for you. I can play at 12, but I have to work at 40, and then I want to kill myself. So you really don't want that, do you, huh? So we're going to do 12, huh? Mm-hmm.
For more library theaters?
Yeah, for the theater, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But these are rules you learn when you're a child, if you're lucky. And I learned when I was very young not to listen to anyone else's taste because it can't be yours. Huh? I wish it could be, but it can't. And the advice they give you is wrong. They tell you not to read comic strips. I did. I've collected all the great comic strips of the world. I collected Buck Rogers when I was 9, and then 50 years later, the Buck Rogers people find out about my love and call me and ask me to write the introduction to the collected works of Buck Rogers. And that's how you get work out of these crazy things. that everyone else thinks are unimportant. Prince Valiant, Tarzan, starting when I was 10. The greatest event in my life was every Saturday night putting on my roller skates and letting my dog pull me downtown Waukegan to buy 2 nickel ice cream cones and the Sunday newspaper where Tarzan was drawn by Harold Foster, who was one of the great illustrators of our time. By the time I was 17, I had all the Tarzan panels put away, and then Prince Valiant started, drawn by Harold Foster. For the next 30 years, I saved all those. Along the way, I wrote him a love letter. I said, you're one of the great illustrators of our time, along up there with Howard Pyle and all the other great illustrators for children's books. And I sent him the same time I met Norman, 42 years ago. And as a result of my writing and telling him I loved him, he sent me 2 huge Prince Valiant originals, which are as big as that whole wall, huh? Hmm. I've got them in my home, and they're museum collector's items now, and they're priceless. And when I die, they will go to the Smithsonian or somewhere like that. But all because, you see, I wrote and said, I love you. And that's what all of life is about, huh? And you build your life then on these love things that no one can tell you about. If I came to you and said, should I collect Buck Rogers? Should I collect Prince Valiant? Well, that's silly, huh? But they're such a part of my life that when I go back and look at them now, 60 years later, mm-hmm. I still get the same elation, huh? It's good stuff. I knew that my selection was right. Huh? Yeah.
In addition to doing what moves you to passion, one thing you have in common is a love of language and love of words and ideas. I was talking to someone before about the need to love the language and love words. And he pointed out, in an illiterate society, it's not like being a blacksmith in a society of drivers, which seems kind of a horrifying thought. There's illiteracy now and the language going downhill, Norman. What do you feel is what's going on now as far as, the writer's role in society?
Well, I think that many, many forces are being destroyed by television, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. Where, thanks to television, the attention span has shortened, the vocabulary has narrowed, much of language has become subverted. Mm-hmm. We go to easy euphemisms, if at all, and it's jargon, it's cant. Look at the level of political writing and utterance today. We haven't had a good, it seems to me, we haven't had a man who could handle the language since perhaps Kennedy. Mm. Certainly nothing to compare with Jefferson, nothing to compare with Lincoln, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and those great giants. Mm-hmm. And I think that a great mistake is being made persistently by schools which neglect to teach at an early age etymology, the origin of words. Mm-hmm. Because our words are so rich, there's such a romance attached to our own language, mm-hmm. that when you think that there are at least 20 words that are commonly used, cereal being one of them, the cereal you eat in the morning, riding on a coach, words that were attached to gods. Cereal was a word that comes from the god of agriculture, the goddess of agriculture, mm-hmm. Ceres.
That's right, yes.
And words of that kind, panic, from the god Pan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The word, and I'll stop at this because one could go on all night, but I was much taken by the fact that the simple flower, the daisy, is so called because to the mintus of our language, those poets really who went around giving names to common objects, thought when they looked at the daisy and saw its golden center and saw the rays, the white, the petals, which seemed like rays of the sun, the golden center representing the sun, and they called that flower the day's eye, which is a beautiful metaphor for the sun, the day's eye, mm-hmm. and it became shortened to daisy. But knowing the origins of words, mm-hmm.
It's fun and games, isn't it?
It makes the student feel attached to his language, to have a proprietary sense of the language. Mm-hmm. He knows something about its history, where it came from, the fact that cobalt, the metal cobalt, was named for a rather nettlesome, mischievous, dreadful little gremlin.
Yes.
Norwegian gremlin called a kobold, so called because the metal was very hard to extract from the ore. It was extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And the miners cursed it and felt that this was a trick of these little demons that made it so hard to handle. Mm-hmm. So it was called kobold and became cobalt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fun and games. Boy, Norman, I'm so glad you brought this up because my wife and myself, and I try to teach it to others, the fun of the very fact that about one fifth of the day we're all talking French. We don't know it, huh? All the IAL words, all the words like ION words, locomotion, official, diminution, ammunition, all the military terms we use, they're all French, or they're Latin based things which became French. Mm-hmm. So the average American, if he goes to France and picks up a newspaper, can read a heck of a lot on that front page, because it's in English, huh? All the words that we have in there, never think about. Volition, huh? Mm-hmm. And all the ION, IAL words. And then dozens of other examples. Or a word like jiffy, you know, we'll be there in a jiffy. And I got to think about that the other night. And this is such fun. You know, you tell this to kids, it makes language fun. And Maggie got to thinking about it. She's I think it's based on something like J apostrophe a Y or I L F A I T, Jaffe. I have done it. I am doing it, huh? Hmm. So Jiffy, huh? Jaffe, mm-hmm. Jiffy. And we've shortened the word and we've changed the pronunciation, but it means I'm doing it, huh? Mm-hmm. So how can you not be interested in words, huh? And we're not doing that in the schools. We're boring the hell out of people. And then we go back to the prime thing we were discussing earlier this evening. The teachers in our system all across the country have been neglecting the first grade now for 30, 40 years, and they're not teaching reading, and that's where it's got to begin, first, second grades. We got to test every teacher in the entire system during the next few years, or our civilization is gone. Huh? It's too late to teach it in the seventh grade. It's too late to teach it, as my wife does, when the students are 20 years old, and she's got to teach them English grammar in order to teach them French. Come on. It's in the first grade. And it doesn't take any money. We're spending $1 billion a day right now on education. We're getting nothing for it. So it's not money, you see. It's the lack of education in the first grade that's destroying our whole culture, especially for boys. If you do not teach them to read and write by the end of second grade, by the time they get into the seventh grade, they're so bored with school because they can't read the books, huh? So they can't get educated, so they become the dropouts and they hit the narcotics. If you want to cure the narcotics problem in this program, you got to go back to the root system. Now, it's too late for some of the generations, huh? Too late. Sorry. I don't know what in the hell you do about them. If you can somehow educate them, get them to reading, you can save them. But all the other things we're talking about, narcotics, mm-hmm. Center back to the first grade and the second grade. And if you educate the kids, you're not going to have the dropouts. But we're not talking about the first grade. I hear a lot of talk about education in the last few years. No one ever talks about the first and second grades. And that way, we're doomed. Huh? Just absolutely doomed.
In a time before television, when you worked in radio and such, the world was a verbal place, largely. We didn't. If you saw what was happening in other countries visually, you saw it in newsreels that you had to go to the theater to go see. Otherwise, you heard it on the radio. Everything hinged on words. Everything doesn't hinge on words so much anymore. Now everything is. We have a visual input. Although TV has been called radio with pictures, it's visual that makes us watch it. Joe Stefano, who we had last week, was talking about. We don't even watch programs anymore. We simply watch the television. Now that you have that remote control where you can go like that, he says, it's, after a while, everyone who has a remote control watches bites of visual.
Except for the good
input.
Shows. Now, the good aspects of television, we have to talk about that too. When you put on a really great show, the next day there's a run in the libraries and the bookstores. You put on Patton, which is a very fine film, mm-hmm. an examination of a very complicated man, of many sides, you know? And we're all fascinated with this man. The next day, you sell 500,000 copies of the books on him, and all the libraries have a run on him. Put on a great idea show like Connections, huh? Burke's series, which has been on 3 times. You sell 1 million books. Huh? Mm-hmm. So there, people don't turn off the good stuff. Once they get hooked, you do a good show on MacArthur. The film on MacArthur with Greg Peck is not a good film, but it's an interesting film. Mm-hmm. And it provokes your curiosity about this man who was a terrible egotist, but also was the perfect emperor of Japan. There was no one more perfect that could have come in and understood the people as completely as he did and saved Japan from itself. And when he, if I were going to do a film on MacArthur, it would start with a parade through the streets and all the Japanese crying. You think, is this a funeral? No. It's the day MacArthur left Japan forever. He had done so well by the people, and they knew it, and they wept at his going. Now, that's a great man, huh? And he came home and made a fool out of himself, huh? But that one period in history of perfection, it gets people to buy books.
Mm-hmm. I have a little story to tell you about MacArthur in Japan. I was going around the world for CBS on a thing called One World Flight and came back and did some programs based on it. And in Japan, an interview with MacArthur was set up. And as Ray has indicated, MacArthur was really the acting emperor of Japan at that time. And I said to a friend of mine, broadcaster Bill Costello at CBS, Bill, I'm going to see General MacArthur tomorrow, and I've prepared some questions, and you're the Japanese hand. Tell me what you think of these questions. And he said, he started to laugh. And I said, why are you laughing? He says, you won't have a chance to talk. So I thought that was hyperbole. He did look at the questions, and he thought they were pretty good questions, but I took them along and, just to make sure that before I got in to see him, I would run over them in my mind. And I came in, and he was very gracious. There he was with the open collar and the pipe. And we sat down, and he started to talk. And for 45 minutes, he talked. And I, at one point, he stopped to, because his pipe went out, and, you know, he's tamping the tobacco his finger in the bowl of the pipe. And I started to ask a question, and he pulled the pipe out of his mouth. He was puffing on it, you know, to light it. Pulled it out of his mouth and continued to talk. What he had to say was, of course, absorbing and wonderful, and he could... Well, he did well to dispense with the possibility of my asking him questions. But the very next night, and you know what, after about 45, 50 minutes, I was aware that I was taking up a lot of his time, and he came to an end, and I thanked him and left. And the next night I had dinner with his one of his generals who was on his staff, and a man named General Baker. And he said to me, I spoke to the general yesterday, and he said, you were one of the most interesting interviewers here.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Well, you traveled all over the world during that period of time.
Yes,
with Edward R. Murrow in London and elsewhere. And did this give you sort of a one-world view that you brought back afterward, and it manifests itself in your work?
Well, no, Joe, I started out, the whole mission was called One World because it was set up in memory of the then late Wendell Willkie, mm-hmm. who had gone around the world as an ambassador at large for Franklin D. Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. For those of a generation who may not remember Willkie, he ran for the presidency against Franklin Roosevelt, one of the 4 times that Roosevelt ran for office and won every time. But he was a very fine man, and Roosevelt asked him to go around the world to visit our allies during the war, while the war was still hot. Mm-hmm. And he did, and came back and wrote a book called One World. Mm-hmm. And it... The thesis of it was that we've got to get together and make it one world, or there'll be no world. Mm. And he died untimely, and a memorial was set up in his honor, in his memory. And that memorial consisted of an award to that person who, in the eyes of the committee, felt had done most during a given year to serve the concept of One World. And Fiorello LaGuardia was awarded it once, and I was awarded it. And on the, under the terms of it, I went around the world, choosing to make it a working trip, not a, certainly a pleasure trip. I worked very hard, took along a recording engineer, and we came back, and I did 13 programs. And the interview with MacArthur was part of the Asiatic leg of that trip.
Mm-hmm. I'm letting you get in here, Larry.
Oh, you are.
I get obsessed sometimes. So.
I know you do. Actually, what I wanted to ask both Ray and Norman is, I have an inordinate interest in the past as opposed to the future. That's why I like to talk to my grandmother, who's, God bless her, is still alive. My grandfathers are all dead, but when before they died, I used to speak to them. Both of you went through the world at war, which Joe, our war, Joe and I went through a war, besides the wars we go through weekly. That was dirty. There was the values of it was muddy. I'm talking, of course, about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You guys went through World War II. I'm looking. I don't even know what my question is. But what I'm looking for is what it did to you. What you were thinking about at those times. You both of you as different aged men at the time, during the war, and the work you've done.
Sorry.
Why? Hello. Who are you? Lafayette Escadrille in there has, Farewell Lafayette in Toynbee Convector.
Yeah.
Is
well,
a story that has a little bit to do with war.
Oh, of course, in all wars because. Mm-hmm. See, I was talking to. I often wonder if men ever talk to their fiancés, their girlfriends, and their wives about. I don't think they do about their honest feelings about war and what it does to the average boy, huh? Starting at the age of 12, or a boy in high school, or a young man. Because there's this dreadful thing that happens. I remember I was in junior high school, when Mussolini began to invade Addis Ababa and Ethiopia, and Mussolini's son was down there talking about all the explosions and the blossoms, and Norman put it in one of his radio shows. But I had nightmares when I was 15 of this great black bulldog coming into my life and eating me alive, so I would never have a life, huh? That's what a war is. And you lie in bed late at night when you're 15, 16, 17, and you think, I wonder if we'll ever have a life. I wonder if anyone will ever know I lived, huh? That's what war is. Millions of people. I have scores of friends buried in France. My uncle from the First World War is buried in outside of Paris. Never had a life, huh? No one ever knew they lived. That's these are the horrible things. Women stay home and they have their life and they get married. They have new loves and they have children. They never have these nightmares, not the same way. Unless they're in the middle of a war, then everyone has nightmares together. But America never had a war here. We've never known. The last war we knew was the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And we were all in that together. Terrible thing happened to the nation. And we still have the wounds. And you go through the South today. Most of them have healed in the North because they were not that deep. But in the South, they're still open. You can talk to people and the wounds are still open. But when you're a boy, as I was in 15, I thought, geez, no one's ever going to know I lived. I'm never going to have a chance to be a writer. I'm never going to know love. I'm never going to know life somewhere. So I went to the New York World. I thought of this again today because ABC called me. I'm going to do a TV show for them in the next 2 weeks about the New York World's Fair, 1939. I went to that. I was a writer who'd never sold anything, and no one knew me. I met all the famous science fiction writers who were just starting then. Isaac Asimov was ahead of me, same age, but he already sold. And I went to the New York World's Fair the night of July 4th, 1939. And I watched the fireworks blossom in the sky. There were a million people at the fair that night, or close to it. And I'm standing there among all the architectures of the future. So beautiful, so beautiful. And war was a few weeks away. A few weeks away. And I thought, oh, God, I better enjoy this while I can. all the beauties. I looked at the night sky with the fireworks and I wept, because I knew I was going to get killed, and no one would ever care that I was ever born. And think of all the guys who had to do that, the night before the storming of the cliffs at Normandy, all those nice young guys who thought, Jesus, what's my life worth, It's this moment I have to go and get killed, and no one will ever remember. And they don't, They remember the event. So this is what I remember of the war, and luckily I was blind enough I didn't have to go fight. I'm very fortunate that way. But I know a lot of other people who were not fortunate enough to be blind, and had to go do it.
Norman?
Well, of course, at that time, I was in radio, and I was appalled by the inexorability of this war. That, in the first place, there were a great many people who saw it coming. People who were outraged, as I was, when Chamberlain went to Munich and kissed the feet of Hitler, when he and Daladier so tidily carved up Czechoslovakia, destroyed that country, and came back, he flourishing the umbrella to say, peace in our time. And the dread was to see it coming and feeling to feel so helpless about not being able to do anything about it. Then when the war came and we got involved in it, there was at least this to be said for it, that, as in the title of Studs Terkel's recent book, it was, if this sounds like an oxymoron, a contradiction of terms, the good war. It was a good war in that there was a palpable evil enemy. We knew what we were fighting for. We knew who we knew who the enemy was, and we knew the nature of his evil. Evil it was indeed. And the Holocaust is so terrifying and so unrelenting in its horror, that I feel it's very important that every new generation be made aware of it, as is happening, fortunately, through filmmakers, largely. Hotel Terminus, which won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Film of the Year. That's a film about that period.
And Shoah.
Shoah, that nine-hour colossal film. These are very important. Well, anyway, there was that terrible sense of outrage to every decent institution that man had created in his in the course of his civilization. And, of course, at the end of the war, there was a sense of relief that we had slain that dragon. It turned out to be illusory, alas. But I was in the position of having to be a celebrant. Not having to be. I did it with great goodwill. But CBS asked me to do to be on the air on the network with an hour broadcast on the night of, on the evening of victory in Europe. And I was, and I wrote that program. It saddens me to realize that that is the last war that anybody would ever feel like celebrating in its conclusion, because nobody is going to win nobody wins any war anymore. Wars now are unwinnable.
That's right. And now there's a book I discovered recently, and I'm sorry I can't tell you the authors because I hadn't heard of them before. I'll try to get the title and call in to you in the next few nights and tell you what it is. It's called 1939. And it gives you the history day by day of that whole year when Russia was playing off both sides. Russia was talking to the French and to the Americans and to England, and at the same time talking to Nazi Germany. And with the English and the French were confused about Russia because they suspected, well, Stalin had already killed 20 million of his own people. It's very unhappy to try and negotiate with a person like this. And in the last week or two before the war began, right up until the very last moment, There was negotiations with England, and then finally the French didn't have their plans made, and then Russia went over to Hitler and said, let's make a deal to destroy Poland. Huh? And Poland was responsible, too, because part of the deal with England and France and America was Poland would allow Russia to move across her territory to attack Hitler if necessary. And Poland was afraid of Russia. Huh? Uh-huh. So she refused that and sealed her own doom, because then Russia turned around and made a deal with Hitler to destroy the whole country. Yeah. So it's a terrible, ironic, dreadful, sad, confused history of a year when peace could have been saved if we had said to Russia at that moment, we'll go in with you, then Hitler would never have started the war. Huh? Terrible, terrible truth, terrible truth.
This is KPFK in Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, Mike Hodel's Hour 25. My name is Joe Straczynski, my co-host is Larry DiTullio, and our guests tonight are Norman Corwin and Ray Bradbury. This show also discusses science fiction in the future as well as
not
as
tonight.
The past. Not tonight, necessarily. But what do you each see in the future for America? Where are we going now, Norman?
I would like to be a lot more cheerful than I have been lately on that subject. I wrote a book called Trivializing America, which addressed itself to the dangers of just what that title implies, that we have become too smug, and we're getting along by going along and finding that mediocrity in so many areas is acceptable and easy and profitable, and so is perpetuated. It is very disturbing to find that there are young people in their 20s from, let's say, 18 to the 30s who don't know that then we have a neighbor to the north named Canada and one to the south named Mexico who can't answer the simplest questions. We have failing scores and in college and other school tests, and I am very worried about what the consequences will be ultimately of a continuation of the phenomenon of living for sensation, a kind of lowering of our standards and taking the bloom off what to Ray and to me and to our generation was so exciting about this country, so rich, so ennobling, inspiriting, the examples out of our own history, which is an extremely colorful and active history, considering that we're a young country. My own father, who died a couple of years ago at the age of 110, I figured out that he was born 50 years after Thomas Jefferson died. That's how young this country is.
Yeah.
And in all that time, up until recently, we've had giants. We've had wonderful people. We've had a lot of knaves. We've had a lot of trouble. We've had a bloody civil war. We've had a lot of trauma. But it's a tremendous country, and still is. I don't mean to say that we're going to hell fast, but I just don't like the corrosive effect. I don't like the attrition that mediocratization and trivialization impose upon us. I would like to see this country made safe for writers, for artists, for poets. Poetry in this country is a neglected art, one of the most ancient. It goes back to the Greeks, if not further back. And yet, Ray, how many men are there, poets, who can make a living today from writing poems? Do you know any?
I can't think of anything right, anyone right now.
Oh.
Well, of course, it's a different... See, when at the turn of the century, we communicated as people did in a way in the caves. Right? Uh-huh. It was a language culture. You had to survive. You had to entertain yourself in your living room. Before that, it was by campfires. But storytellers still had positions, so that meant poetry had a place. Now we've had all this, we've had the proliferation of magazines, the proliferation of newspapers. It's an accumulative thing from the availability of novel, of knowledge on many levels, of some of it very good. But since we don't talk as much in our living rooms, we don't declaim, huh? Mm-hmm. We don't need Papa to get up and read from the Bible every night because we have radio, mm-hmm. for starters, 1922. And then we had movies that talked. And then we had television. Now we have video cassettes. And we have more and more LP records. Now we have symphonies from all over the world. Any symphony you want to hear right now, you can have. And you can have it free. Right? You go to the library and borrow it. So all these things are there. We have more selection. So that means what Norm is talking about is that we don't declaim poetry enough. But it should come back in at another level, which means teaching reading in the first, second grades. Then when you fall in love is when poetry comes in handy. We need that language later, not only to enrich all of our other art forms, because you learn from poetry how to be a good filmmaker. I was talking to Norman about this on the way here tonight. One of the reasons I think I'm a pretty good screenwriter is my knowledge of haiku. Huh? Mm-hmm. And every haiku is a shot, a scene. Huh? And I was saying if I were teaching cinema tomorrow, I would have all the students write haiku and then shoot them. Huh? Not shoot the students, but shoot the haiku.
No, I actually did that in film school.
Yeah.
I actually filmed a haiku film,
sure,
and it was dreadful.
Well, there you go.
It was an interesting experience.
Let's tell these good listeners what a haiku is. Not many of them.
A haiku is a Japanese form of poetry, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, 5 syllables. The first line is 5 syllables, the second is 7, and the last is 5. So it makes 17 syllables.
17 syllables.
In all. And I did a film with 17 shots, which I called haiku.
Sure.
And it was just really wretched.
You know that.
Sorry about that.
But it was a good try.
You know, it may seem to...
It was a minute. That was my problem. The film had to be a minute, and it was too quick to do a haiku in a minute.
It may seem to the person unfamiliar with forms of poetry that the arbitrary character of a haiku consisting of 17 syllables is a stern kind of a discipline, too rigid to be creative in. Yet the sonnet, the classical form, was very much a formula poem. It consisted of 14 lines of iambic pentameter. And it never, well, now and then there would be an extended sonnet, but the classical sonnet was a 14-line poem, very rigid. And yet within that, a whole world of beauty and thought could be revealed. And this was the challenge to the writer. It's not bad to have to create your work within a short space and fill it with meaning and power and beauty.
I found haiku fascinating. I used to write dozens of them. They were all wretched too. But
well, the ones
I found
that are
very
really,
creative.
The ones that are
looking
really great
for words
are
to
heartbreaking.
Fit.
You know, there's one I probably will misquote it, but a lady remembers her dead child is the title. Today, how far might he have wandered, my little hunter of dragonflies? Huh? Mm. Jesus, you know, it kills you, huh? Anyone who's ever had a child die on them knows what that poem is about. Or I wrote a semi-haiku recently. Last night at 3 a.m., I went into Baskin-Robbins and asked for you. The 32nd flavor, they said, all out. I went out in the rain and wept. It's not a haiku, but it's close.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Earlier on, and over dinner, you were talking about the differences between men and women and boys and girls growing up. And I was kind of surprised when you pointed out at one juncture, Ray, that you felt that, in a way, the first best destiny of a woman is to be a childbearer.
Well, it always has been. I don't know how you're going to change it. And if women don't want to have children, that's fine. But then they mustn't protest later that life has cheated them. I saw a quote from Simone de Beauvoir a few years ago in which she claimed life had cheated her. And my response was, no, you cheated yourself. You decided not to have children. And that's a terrible decision. You better know what you're doing. Don't let anyone else influence you about this. It has to come from the heart. You got to make sure you're not going to miss it, because I know a lot of people, intellectuals, of all sizes and shapes, who decided at the age of 28 or 30, oh, well, we're not going to have kids. We're going to enjoy life. We're going to really, you know, be creative and nonsense. And they got to be 60 suddenly, and they looked around, and there was nothing. Huh? There was nothing. And it was too late. It's too late. So these are very serious questions. They cannot be solved easily. I have no complete formula. But all I say is, look to your ganglion. Huh? Don't make intellectual decisions. Look to your ganglion. Look to your heart. Look to your stomach. I make all my important decisions with my stomach. Huh? I never intellectualize. I go in for meetings with people. If I come out and my stomach's upset, I don't take the job. It's that simple. I don't kid myself. See, rationality can kid you. You can go to a meeting and come out and say, well, that guy's a crumb, but... huh? I can get the word. I can lick him. Well, that's nonsense. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But Norma and I have been through this time and again. You meet some pretty dreadful people around. Uh-huh. And they put the butter on you, and oh, they're sweet, and oh, boy, are they friendly. And you smell the beast inside the butter, huh? And head for the exit, huh? So that's all I'm saying for any woman or any man about any important decision in your life. You're going to get married, or you're never going to get married. You're going to have a creative life. Well, of course, you're not, huh? Chances are you're not.
Having a child makes every man and woman half a god.
Yep, yep. You laugh all the time. My grandchildren come over to the house to visit. I have six of them now, you know, and the latest came over, my grandson, and he's 4 months old, you know. As soon as he comes in the door, I start laughing, you know. I don't stop for hours, and he goes, and I feel good the rest of the day. How can you tell that to anyone? I couldn't tell any of all my daughters were feminists, you know. Oh, boy, you know, feminist movement is all great. Now that three of them have children, and they all look at them, and one of my daughters said the other day, I didn't know what joy was. I said, that's right. No way to tell you till the thing is there. And you look at it, and you say, God, I never wanted to leave. I wrote a little poem about one of my granddaughters, sent it to my, when one of my grandchildren was sick about a year ago, Mallory, my little granddaughter, and my daughter called me. She says, my God, what if she should die? And I said, yeah, that's the most horrible thought, you know. And she said, and then the other thought, she said, I never wanted to go away. I said, that's right. I never wanted you to go away. And when you were 18 and I took you down the bus station to send you to Pomona, 40 miles away, huh? What did we do in the train station, huh? We cried, huh? Because it was the beginning of the time of going away, huh? And that's what family is. And there's no way to tell you about family until you have it. And then sometimes it's too late, huh? So all these things you think you want to do, make sure it really comes from the heart and not from some concept outside yourself or from some well-meaning book whose author will change their mind later, huh? About like Simone de Beauvoir did, too late in time. So she had an empty life, empty life.
You brought it up. It's for you to respond.
I was just surprised by it.
Next subject.
Actually, in Toynbee Convector, you have an excellent story about family, which I just read this afternoon. I can't remember the title. I remember it. Oh, I suppose you are wondering.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Which is, I don't want to blow the story for anybody, but it's about a guy who brings back his parents.
Yeah, of course, the difficult thing about the other aspect of families is that we love them so much. We love our parents very much, and they love us. That doesn't mean we get on, but you learn to accept diversity in family. That's the first thing, especially boys who are rambunctious and argumentative, and you know, when they're 17, they know everything there is to know, right? And but I had a thing happen when I was 33. I'd never been away from home. I lived with my parents till I was 27 because I couldn't afford to leave. I had no money. And I got on pretty well with my dad. You know, we had political arguments, but pretty darn good, you know. He didn't know anything. But when I got the job of writing Moby Dick for John Huston, It was the first time I ever traveled, first time I ever had any money, first time I was going to live in a hotel, first time I ever eaten a restaurant. Huh? Never been away from home more than 5 miles since I was born. And I was going to be gone for a year. Whole new experience with my wife and my two kids. My dad came over to visit me the day before I left for the East, and he brought my grandfather's gold watch. Yeah? He put it in my hand, and he embraced me and kissed me and stood back, and there were tears in his eyes. And I thought, my God, you know, stupid, stupid boy, stupid son, not to know the depth of the love your father has. Huh? And here are his tears. First time I ever saw tears in his eyes. And I wept too. And after that, never any nonsense. Never any political arguments. Who cares, huh? Who cares? Why is it important? It's not. Huh? All these stupid arguments that go on in families. I just shut my mouth, and I accepted his diversity and his differentness. Why does everyone have to be the same, huh? And why do you have to agree with me? To hell with that, huh? Mm-hmm. So I love my father intensely for the last 7, 8 years of my life, and proved it all the time, and said it all the time. And I try to teach this when I go to graduations. I was at Art Center 15 years ago, and it was all male students at that time. I looked out all these young faces, 21, 22 years old, and I looked at all the fathers and mothers there. And I said to all these young men, I said, now, I want to cut down some time for you here. Why should you go on being stupid idiots the way you are about love? I want to teach you a lesson here today. Because you've got people here today who love you so much that if anything ever happened to you, they'd never get over it, you know? That's what parental love is. I had aunt and uncle whose boy died when I was 13. He was my age. Boom, he was gone in a day, huh? They never got over it. They pretended. Oh, they pretended. But the only son. And the rest of their life was a wreck. Huh? And as it would be for any of us. Sure, we'd make a brave front. But, oh, boy, that's the one thing that terrifies all of us. So I said, look, you got half the people here today, you already know they love you and you love them, huh? But there's another half here today, your fathers are here, huh? What have you done about that, huh? Do you realize that if anything happened to any of you here, your father would never recover, huh? Never recover. He's not going to tell you this, but I'm telling you this. And then I told the story of my father and the gold watch. I said, why should you wait till you're 33? You going to be as stupid as I was? Or when the graduation is over today, are you going to run over to your father? I want you to grab him. I want you to lift him in the air. I want you to hug him and kiss him and say, Dad, I love you. And for all the years and the gift of my life, much thanks. When the graduation was over, pandemonium. Pandemonium, huh? I never saw so much love and so much weeping. And a man came up to me on the street a week later. And he says, you know, you changed my life. I said, who are you? He says, I was at the graduation. My son came up to me and lifted me and hugged me and kissed me and said, Dad, I love you. And boy, have we had a life, huh? Have we had a life? And you've given it to us. So, boy, these are the things to talk about, huh? These are the important things. Everything else is crap. Everything else in life is crap if you don't get all this junk out of the way, huh? And get right to the center of your family. Sure, you're going to have these disagreements. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean a damn thing. Next subject.
See what I mean about Bradbury?
Well, let me ask you a question, Ray. You have issued visas to many of the dead to cross back over into the world of the living. And you've done it very well in some of your greatest stories. Do you consider Shirley MacLaine a trespasser?
Oh, dear. Oh, well, you know, she's floating half an inch off the ground, and I hope when she lands, it's an easy landing. Well, we all have relatives like that, don't we, huh? Aunts or uncles and who were put pyramids up in the living room, put razor blades under them, you know. Do you remember that a couple of years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Supposed to keep a razor blade sharp.
The best way to do it was actually to drink tequila most of the day and sit in one, and it worked.
Well, that I approve of, yeah. You never age there, anyway. Boy.
Oh, a friend of mine actually did that. He built a pyramid. He built it perfectly, and he built it collapsible. He said, because you don't want a pyramid up. But he built a full-size so that, that two people could sit under.
Well, said, if you're lucky, you
said, let's try it. He said, we'll sit here. So we got a bottle of tequila, and we sat on this pyramid. And I said, you know, I think it's working. I'm, well, of course, this was about, after half the bottle of tequila, we felt, yes, pyramid power was,
as, nothing doesn't hurt
as a matter of fact, was working.
Yeah, you live in an alternate universe, don't you?
Yeah, he put it over his bed, and the lady he was living with, who he's still living with, made him take it down.
She was pyramid-shaped, too. That helped.
He said he got too mellow, and he got mellow in there, and he didn't want to make love anymore, and so she made him take it down. But we had a good time drinking tequila under it. That's the only way it works.
We are at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. If you have any questions or comments for Ray Bradbury or Norman Corwin. I was curious, Norman, we were talking earlier about making choices and staying away from things that don't make you happy. And I've always thought it unfortunate you haven't done more work in television than you have, particularly given how memorable everything you do has been there. I mean, you did the Network at 50 piece, which Walter Cronkite read, which every line of which is indelibly etched in my head. First panel lit up reading on the air, then words and music. That signal was barely started toward Andromeda, hurriedly at the speed of starlight, and already we arrived for Jubilee. I had the entire thing in my head, Norman, from hearing it once. And your work is so startling. What are your feelings about writing for television? Are you distancing yourself from it?
No, but you see, it takes two to tango, and the first and the leading step is always from the producer. If I were to have written Network at 50 on my own and brought it to CBS, I doubt they would have been interested. Mm-hmm. But they had a 50th anniversary, and they were looking around for some mode of commemoration. Most of that week-long commemoration was rehashing old programs, and they brought to the tube, brought to the camera, people who were still with us from back those back in that age, and they decided that they wanted to top it off with something of a substance and something that represented some thought, and they came to me and asked if I would write that piece. Mm-hmm. So it was commissioned. Mm-hmm. But I have no illusions that were it not for that, I could never have sold that. So, you know, knowing that, why should I sit down and write it? Mm-hmm. I wrote it on order. Mm-hmm. And I will do it again if they come to me. Anybody, you know, I can be had, in other words. If somebody wants the kind of thing that I can bring to television, I'm there.
Mm-hmm. But, let's put out the good word tonight. I mean, yeah. It's really ridiculous.
I agree.
I mean, if anyone out there is listening tonight, for God's sake, you know, there should be the World of Corwin on every week for mm-hmm. 19 weeks.
I agree.
And or Norman did a series in Canada. How many were on that, Norman?
26 weeks. Terrific show.
PBS ought to get those and rerun them, huh? Mm-hmm. For starters. But then, well, you know, we live in the age, too, where everything new has to be brand new. And as if there is something magical about that. Well, I believe in encouraging new talent. But I attended a meeting in Beverly Hills about 12 years ago. They were forming a new theater guild. They wanted to encourage new talent. In the middle of the of the evening, I said, well, do you mind if I speak up? And they said, what? I said, I'm new talent. I'm unproduced. I'm 55 at the time. But hell, you know, no one's producing me, so no one's seen my plays, so I'm brand new. Does it have to be a 26-year-old? How about someone who loves the theater? Mm-hmm. Norman's got a couple of really terrific plays that haven't been seen for years. What is it called? Together Tonight?
Yes.
Get Together mm-hmm. Tonight. One of the best historical dramas ever written for the theater. It's never. I don't think it's ever been seen here in town, has it? Or maybe
never,
one or two.
Never seen in Los Angeles. No.
And someone should get that and produce it. Alexander Hamilton,
Burr,
yeah,
and Jefferson.
Jefferson, and based on the real letters, the real encounters of these exciting people. It doesn't sound exciting right offhand because we've managed to bore ourselves so often with our own history, yeah. But not this. This is a very dynamic exchange between these vital people, mm-hmm. and. A lot of good material here that should be explored, especially by PBS, who says they want to do good work. Yeah. And we got all kinds of talent in this town, like Norman, who haven't been touched yet.
Mm-hmm. Also, for those listening, Norman, when it comes to humor, Norman, your stuff is outstanding.
Absolutely.
Things like My Client Curly and the Undecided Molecule, which we played here, mm-hmm. With your permission. A while ago, I mean, this stuff is just—it's witty, it's funny, it's still witty and it's funny. So if you're looking for a man for all seasons, Norman Corwin.
We did the collaboration, my Irish play, a comedy, which Norman directed and cast, and you get that and play it some night. I guess we can play it, can we?
Sure.
And it's hilarious. It's one of the—it's a great production. So we'll send a tape over.
Terrific.
You guys play it some
night.
And we got people like Bill Schallert. And Bobby Ball, mm-hmm. and Monty Markham, wonderful mm-hmm. cast. And, we'll send it over.
Great.
And go to the library and check out Norman's book, 13 by Corwin, More by Corwin.
The library is there.
Holes in a Stained Glass,
Ego,
Trivializing America.
It's fun.
And we'll take some calls now. And you're in Hour 25 with Ray Bradbury and Norman Corwin.
Yeah, Larry and gang, I had two questions for Ray.
Yeah.
One, I'd like to hear again your definition of science fiction and Singing in the Rain.
Oh, well, you know, we have all been looking at that greatest musical of all time for 30 years or 35 years or so now, and without realizing, we're looking at a science fiction film. And people say, the what? And, of course, what it is a metaphorical examination of a technological destruction and reconstruction in the midst of our society. 1 year was all silence, huh? And then sound came along, and all the people got fired. Panic, revolution, huh? People running around the streets wondering what to do with their lives. And then sound got established and came in. So what you have is the history of the development of a technology, huh? A dream. 1 year was a dream. And then all these technicians figured out how to integrate film with sound. Of course, it had been going on for 20 years before, but it came to fruition in 1927. So that's what science fiction is. A dream becoming a fact, the fact becoming science, and then you move on to the next dream. So Singing in the Rain is a perfect example. And in the middle of Lawrence of Arabia, there's a science fictional scene. What is it? The king of the Arabs, whom Lawrence is seeking out, is being bombarded by a newfangled thing called an airplane. And bombs are being dropped on him. And he doesn't know what they are. And Lawrence says, you'll have to move your army back. And he says, yes. He says to Lawrence, my men don't know what guns and ships are, airships. Huh? And so that's a science fictional moment, a change in history. 14 years later, that couldn't have happened. The airplane hadn't been invented, huh? Mm-hmm. Or it was primitive, so it couldn't be used. These moments in history are science fictional moments. And from then on, the whole history of war is the history of impossible dreams becoming realities. And then when the atom bomb comes into the world, the whole history of war changes and the whole history of peace. Mm-hmm. We've managed to have a very uneasy peace for a long time between major powers because of the definition given to it by a nuclear power. Sad, but true.
We don't even have to go as far as airplanes and great historic hardware revolutions. The other day, I was in a lawyer's office, and there had to be a change in a document. And my lawyer, this is in Los Angeles, my lawyer picked up the phone, called somebody in Pasadena. The change was made in an office there, and it came back on modem on a laser printer, and there was the revised page, which had traveled from here to Pasadena and back in less time than it takes me to describe what happened. Mm-hmm. This is science fiction. All of these incredible things. You call up a phone company and you say, I want to challenge an item in your bill. And they say, and what is your what is your phone number? You tell it. They say, okay, I have it in front of me. Now, yeah. I have thousands and thousands and thousands of subscribers. They have your bill. And they're able to zero in on an item, on that call to Walnut Creek. And you know, that is absolute magic. Mm-hmm. Sitting and working in front of your word processor, mm-hmm. and all the magic. You say, I want to change all the names of where I say John Bradbury. That doesn't sound as good as Ray Bradbury. Mm-hmm. I want to like to change the John to Ray, and you have the word, the name Ray 600 times in the course of this manuscript, and you give the machine a command, and all the Johns become Ray instantaneously. Mm-hmm. That's science fiction too.
Yes.
Okay, right. Question about Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
I know it's been a long time since I've seen or read the book, but I know the endings are different, and I preferred the book ending, and I know you prefer the film one, or at least I thought I heard you say that, and I'm wondering why, since you wrote the book, and I am sure you knew at the time you were writing it why you wrote it that way. Why? What changed your mind to like the film ending better?
No, I didn't write the film ending. The Truffaut did that, and also an accident in weather caused the ending of the film to be made the way it was. They were out in the wilderness shooting the book, people walking around, remembering their lines, and it began to snow. And people said, well, let's get back to the studio. It's ruining everything. And Truffaut, I believe, said, no, let's stay and use the snow. And, of course, it was a great decision because the impact of the words of Poe and Melville and Whitman and what have you being spoken by the characters as they walk through the gently falling snow mm-hmm. was heartbreaking, along with the music of Herman. So, you see, there's room in my heart for all kinds of qualities of excellence. I may very well love the ending of my book the way I wrote it, but I also respect Truffaut when he comes up with a brilliant idea like that and has enough sense to leave the cameras running. Huh? Right. So it's one of the great endings. It's fun to play the game, isn't it, of naming the great endings on movies that you remember forever. Like at the Some Like It Hot, Joey Brown saying, nobody's perfect, and Norma Desmond coming down the stairs for her close-up at the end of Sunset Boulevard. Mm-hmm. The rosebud sled on the flames at the end of Citizen Kane.
Louis reaching for the butterfly.
There you go. Mm. Yeah, All Quiet on the Western Front. Mm. And so Fahrenheit, to me, is not my film. It's Truffaut's film.
Yeah.
And I respect my directors if I love them. And if Norman, when we work together, comes up with an idea that's as good as or better than mine, I'd be a fool not to say, heck, I'll borrow that, and mm-hmm. I'll put it in the next script, huh?
Gotcha.
And then I'll claim it's mine.
Thank you for calling. On to the next call, and you're in hour 25. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for Mr. Bradbury.
Yeah.
You've worked in a variety of media, in a variety of genres. I was just wondering if there was one that you felt that you weren't real good at, or you weren't real pleased with your performance in. I mean, is there one area that gives you trouble and that you
continually
work at?
I'm still learning about theater. Though I've read all the major plays of the last 100 years or so, 200 years, Molière and Shakespeare and all the people of the 20th century, I'm still learning and I'm making mistakes. That's fine. I love to make mistakes, because it's a way of learning. And I wrote a long play 18 years ago, Leviathan 99, which was a disaster, mainly because I didn't cut it. The idea was good. The short version I did for radio 2 years before worked, and I was too dumb to see that. And in fact, I wrote it for Norman Corwin to direct. Mm-hmm. And when I finished it 25 years ago, and we sent it to NBC saying, well, Norman and I are ready, and NBC got back, called us back and said, can you cut this down into 3-minute segments? That's a true story.
Oh,
so I'm still learning in theater. I'm still learning in poetry. I think I've learned the short story form after 500 short stories. I'm still learning in the novel form, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Norman, how about you? Any area you're still working on?
Well, yes, I have never really addressed myself to a novel. Mm-hmm. And that puts me years behind Ray. I have worked in other forms. Mm-hmm. And if I were to live as long as my father lived and were able to function as well as he did, I would try those forms, but that seems unlikely.
I want to put another bug in your ear. I'm always putting bugs in Norman's ear. But it seems to me, any composers tonight listening, I mean, Norman is perfect to work with composers. He's done it in the past, but he should do it more in the future. The country is full of young composers looking for ideas, looking for metaphors that they can do little short operas on. So it seems to me that since Norman hasn't done half enough in this field, he should be working with more composers.
That's borne out by the fact that Lynn Murray, a composer who flourished in the golden age of radio and who has since then done scores for the National Geographic, is now working on a musical version of The Plot to Overthrow Christmas, which is the first radio show I ever owned.
Oh, that's great. Didn't you also do a libretto for the UN called a Yes, Picard, Yes?
Yes, I did. Yes, that was performed by the Minneapolis Symphony, as a matter of fact, at the Assembly Hall of the United Nations, but it was not, I do not look upon it as a successful work. It, it was a good try, but not everything succeeds.
Okay. We'll take another call at 818-985-5735, and you're on with Norman Corwin and Ray Bradbury.
Yes, the show has been interesting thus far, and I would like...
No, it hasn't been interesting. It's been fascinating.
Yes.
And now it's downhill from
here, I guess. I'd like to go to a somber note, however. I'd like to compare the Apollo 1 fire to the Challenger disaster. It seems to me that the Challenger disaster had far more impact on the nation and the space program than the Apollo 1 fire, which I think was a bit more important to the space program. Do you have any comments why this seems to be so, if you do agree with me?
Now, Ray, you're talking about this at dinner, as a matter
of fact. Yeah, yeah. Well, we've become disaster-oriented. We got to have our weekly disaster. This week is the oil spill. We overkill everything. Two weeks ago, it was two grapes, and I say sour grapes. You know, give me the grapes, I'll eat the goddamn things, and we'll all get back to normal again. Stupid, stupid, stupid. So turn off your TV sets. Stop all the disasters. We've allowed the Challenger disaster of 2 years or 3 years ago to ruin the space effort until recently. We allowed the Three Mile Island accident, which we call disaster. It wasn't. See, we overkilled with these words. There was no disaster. No one got hurt. No one got killed. It's destroyed the whole nuclear industry. That means we're behind France, who by the end of the century will have all the power in the country delivered by safe nuclear power. And Germany and Japan are being left behind. We're going to be a fourth-rate nation because we panic at TV shows. Three Mile Island was a TV charade. It was false. It was a lie from the beginning. And Jane Fonda and all the other people that participated in it were lying. Now we got to cut that out. So the Challenger disaster, you can't run it every hour for 24 hours, 48 hours, and every year doom us all over again with a disaster and have a creative country. We're going to have. We've all got to die for our ideas. To create sailing ships, tens of thousands of people died going around the world. Columbus lost countless crews long before he started on his journeys. So we've only lost a few people, and each one of them very valuable to their families and to us. But we've allowed ourselves to be doom-ridden by our television sets, by the grapes, by the oil spill. It's not a disaster. It's unfortunate. We can clean it up. We can go on. We can build the pipelines if we have to. And we've discovered that the animals will leap them. The tundra doesn't get destroyed the way they all told us. It's always a disaster, huh? Let's open some of the oil wells in Texas. I've never understood why it costs more money to run an oil well in Texas than to import it all the way from Alaska. Someone please explain it to me some other year. I don't want to hear it tonight. But, I mean, turn off all these things. Let's get on with the future. We're going to rebuild all of our cities between now and the end of the century. Corporate imagination will replace civic imagination, because civic imagination has always been dumb and stupid. All the chambers of commerce in all of the cities of our country don't know a damn thing about running business or cities. None of the city fathers know, none of our state governments know, and the federal government doesn't know anything about creativity. All the good things that have happened in our country in the last 25 years have come from corporate enterprise knowing how to grab a metaphor and run with it. That's Disney. Yeah. Recreating the cities of the future. Giving us examples of how to socialize again, how to humanize, how to be part of one another's lives, how to get crime out of the streets, how to rebuild all the cities. So with Disney as our corporate inspirer, along with IBM and other forward-looking corporations, huh? Mm-hmm. We're going to rebuild our total culture. I'm completely optimistic about this because I'm in the middle of it. I've helped design three malls now in the last 25 years. Glendale Galleria is based on a plan of mine I wrote the LA Times 20 years ago. I was a consultant on the West Side Pavilion and the Horton Plaza with the John Gerdy Company. And since the city fathers are too dumb to create the cities, then corporate imagination must do the job and show us how to live. Mm-hmm. So this is all of the good. And then someday the cities will have enough brains to imitate the malls and recreate the cities themselves.
Having worked for Disney myself, I must say that the idea of Disney running the country is a very ominous one to me.
Not ominous at all, because he's changed all of our lives almost for the good. He cared about the quality of lives.
Oh, Walt did, but the corporation remains.
The influence of Disneyland on all the mayors of America has caused them to go back and plant gardens with hundreds of thousands of flowers that are not needed. See, all the things that we don't need that we do anyway mm-hmm. are what Disney taught us. Mm-hmm. And you learn that at Disneyland. Benches, parasols, places to sit, places to people watch, safe places to congregate. Mm-hmm. And a lady from the Novella Observatoire called me 2 years ago. She said, Monsieur Bradbury, how does it feel now that Disney will come to France? All those toys and games outside Paris. I said, my dear young woman, it's not toys and games. It's France's gift of itself to itself. She mm-hmm. says, what do you mean? I said, don't you know how much Walt Disney loved Paris and France, your gardens, your restaurants, your humanity, your cities, a million people on the streets every night walking and living and having good lives? That's what he built into Disneyland, mm-hmm. along with the architecture of the greatest French architects that he learned from Chambord and Vaux-le-Vicomte and dozens of other places, including the work of Villeneuve-le-Duc, who recreated Notre Dame and the spire on top of it. I said, he has offered France as an example to us, teaching us how to live, and now he's going to bring you back to you. And she says, oh, Monsieur Bradbury, you make me so happy. I said, because it's the truth. I heard him say it in his office years ago. So now all the cities are going to be rebuilt on the example the French have given us through the sieve of Disney mm-hmm. back into our lives. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
Norman, a reaction to this?
Well,
Now, if you're talking about their films, the films are dreadful. That's another thing.
No, well, you know, I rather feel, though, Ray, that L'Enfant has contributed more to the French influence on American architecture than Disney.
Now, who's this?
L'Enfant, who built laid out Washington, D.C.
Well, you know. Disney borrowed from him, you see. That's what I'm saying, that Disney influenced by him and what he saw in Paris from the French architects there. And from, I'll give you a final example. I went to Disneyland 3 years ago after returning from France, and I looked up on the side of Sleeping Beauty's castle, and I saw this spire by Villeneuve-le-Duc, who's one of the great architects of 1870, who rebuilt Notre Dame, Chambord, and what have you. I called John Hench on the phone out at Disney Imagineering. I said, John, how long has Villeneuve-le-Duc's spire been on the side of Sleeping Beauty's castle at Disneyland? He says, 30 years. I said, 30 years? I never noticed. I said, who put it there? He said, Walt. I said, why? Because he loved it. Mm-hmm. I said, because he loved it. So you see, I'm agreeing with Norman's point. The French architects are Disneyland, and that's his gift to us. And if we learn from it, we rebuild our cities and live well.
Okay. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a few things. First of all, I wanted to thank Ray for all the beautiful stories and stuff he's given me, like, since I was real little. And I had a question and a comment. Ray, is that story about Mr. Electrico when you were young a true story, or is that kind of like...
No, it's true.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah, I met him. Yeah.
Great.
And he was very kind to me. And he did two things to me. The night I met him, he said, live forever.
Yeah, I read
that. And then the next day when I met him on the beach and talked to him, he said, we've met before. And I said, where was it? He said, in the great war of 1918 in France, in the battle of the, one of the...
Ardennes Forest?
Ardennes Forest, yes. Yeah. And he said, you died in my arms, and you're my best friend, and now you're back in the world. Now, why he said those two things to me I'll never know. I never knew the man. He was a defrocked Presbyterian minister, he told me.
That would explain it.
Lived in Cairo, Illinois, and I wrote to him for a while when I was 12, but I lost track. Mm-hmm. But because of him, I began to write within 3 months of my last encounter.
Okay. What's your comment? Make it fast.
Okay, the comment was basically about the nuclear power. I think it's a little too early to say that that these weren't disasters because radiation kills slowly over time. And I agree that nuclear energy will be safe, but that'll be when we develop fusion, and I think fusion's kind of a dead end. That's about it.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, now, right. What we do is bring in the French and the Japanese to teach us how to build the safe plants, okay?
And build a better croissant.
Yeah. A famous French architect.
You're on Hour 25 with Norman Corwin and Ray Bradbury. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not going to live in a city with rodents the size of men.
You're mumbling.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to kind of take exception to the thing earlier.
I'm sorry. If you can't find your topic within 30 seconds, I don't know. You're gone. You're on the air. Go ahead. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I wanted to say I heard you earlier when you were talking about the differences with the societies.
You have 20 seconds. You're down to 10 now. Now you're down to 5.
imagination.
Yes.
Radio gives people imagination. People just see things on TV. That's just one person's vision. And radio, you could just, make up everything you wanted to in your head.
Right.
It's only 20 seconds. You're kidding?
No, that's a scene from The Producers with Zero Mostel making Gene Wilder very nervous. He says, you have 60 seconds, now you're 90 or 45. Quick, talk.
And the other thing was a comment. There's a promo announcer they have on KPFK sometime by, can't think of the guy, that talks about billions and billions of years ago.
Sagan.
Hey, Carl Sagan. About how so much of the media appeals to the animal part of the brain.
Oh, I hope so.
What is the other part that it's revealed?
Well, I don't know, but I've been trying to find it for years. But,
but all right, we have to move on.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm getting out of hand. It's late at night.
You're on with Norman Corwin and Ray Bradbury. Go ahead.
Yeah, just one more thing about the nuclear. And the utter safety of the nuclear.
I'd rather actually hold. I would much rather have a discussion of nuclear power on another night when we have
a
whole
have
evening.
Yeah, more time. Yeah.
More time for
let's
the
talk about women.
We have a couple of nuclear physicists.
Good evening.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Galleria is nice. Glendale
Thank
developed
you.
Around it.
Thank you.
West Side, I don't like. It seems like an irritant on the surroundings.
There are problems with traffic, and I'm not responsible for that. Only the good stuff inside. Yeah.
Do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Living
testy
peace.
With these callers now.
No, we have only 10 minutes left with these
and
people.
I'm getting out of my manic phase. I'm starting to get depressed, so quick.
All right, make it fast. Go ahead.
Hi there. I've got a question for Ray Bradbury. Is there a way I can get his autograph on a wonderful Russian book? It's it was made by you. It's foreign. Fahrenheit 451, but it's all in Russian.
That's right. They published it there without realizing I was criticizing them. That's the great thing about science fiction. You can call people stupid, and they come up and say, gee, this is a great book here. I said, it's all about you and book burning under Stalin. Huh? So send it to the station here, and they will send it to me, and I'll autograph it and get it back to you, okay?
And I also have another statement real quick about Russia seems to be opening up their lines to a lot of science fiction lately. I have a friend, Boris Alexandrovich Zavgorodny, an awfully long name to say, but he's got a neat science fiction fan club there in Russia. It's called The Winds of Time. Anyway, they're organizing a Soviet-American science fiction fan meeting in the middle of September in Russia. I don't know where, but they're trying to get it across.
Well, listen, do me a favor, will you?
Yeah.
They've been stealing my books for 30 years. They owe me $5 million in old royalties, and they've never sent one kopeck to me. And the Soviet Minister of Culture sent me telegrams 5 years ago, said, Mr. Bradbury, how we can improve cultural relationships between Russia and the United States? I cabled back, send the rubles. So you get my money out of there, and I'll go to their meeting. Okay.
One thing dawned on me just now. We talked about the state of television now, what's happening in television. Ray, what is your impression of the state of radio now?
You're looking at Norman.
I'm sorry, Ray. Yeah, what's your impression of the state of radio now?
Well, radio is moribund. In terms of radio drama, it certainly is alive and kicking. when it comes to disc jockeys, and it comes to the country music and rock music and the stations that specialize. KPFK is a specialist station.
And what we don't know, but...
But I think that if your question is addressed to radio drama, mm-hmm. I think that radio was eclipsed by television and will stay in a perpetual shadow. Because when there is a big money to invest in a dramatic production, it'll go to television.
Yeah.
If a new Shakespearean play were discovered in a back alley of Stratford, it would go to television, not to radio.
Let me contradict you for a moment, Norman. Sometime in the next 7 years, Norman and I are forming a new tape drama company called Gridlock Productions. And in the middle of traffic gridlock, Norman Corwin will be reborn as the Shakespeare of the century.
There you go.
Because people will be locked in traffic for 3 hours, and they got to listen to something. You can't listen to that moron music forever. I mean, you know, come on. Let's not kid yourself. So, Gridlock Productions, you watch for our tapes now. Norma and I will put them out, and we'll both have new careers in radio.
I was just, thank you, Ray.
I'm going to hold you this.
Very happy prospect.
Write this down. We're on tape. We don't have to worry.
You know, never is a long time. That is not to say that radio drama can never come back. It could come back if an audience becomes fed up with what they're getting on the tube.
Mm-hmm.
It could come back conceivably. It has never left some countries. Britain's still on as radio drama, so do the Scandinavian countries, so does Australia.
Okay. All right. And you're on R25. You have like 30 seconds. Go.
Okay. Hello. I'm Dave from Homosa. I just wanted to know if Ray Bradbury knew that his mall was called It's a Mall World. And also, I was wondering if the combination of science fiction writers or creativity in being writers and also their interest in things in the future, I'm wondering if they're better predictors of the future, and if so, is the sense in the scientific community one of optimism because of the spread of democracy and freedom, or is it one of pessimism because of the ozone hole, etc.?
I think you've just covered about
two hours worth
of lecture there. That's, I think, a long question we can't even get into at this point, really, quite frankly.
Basically optimistic, and if we're dramatic and willful and imaginative, the ozone holes will also go away. Huh?
Okay. A couple of last things very briefly. We're almost out of time. What's the novel you're working on now? Just may come out next year sometime.
I'm doing a sequel to my murder mystery called Falling Upward. Mm-hmm. That's a tentative title. It's about Hollywood when I was a kid. I used to roller skate around and bug people like George Burns when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy, and it'll be out next year. Mm-hmm.
And also, I wanted to bring up the ad, which you wanted to respond to.
Oh, the ad and the article in the paper the other day about Pacifica,
yes,
referring to George Bush as the Ayatollah Khomeini,
mm-hmm,
which I thought was ridiculous. And you can't overkill with that sort of insult, because George Bush had nothing to do with the thing that was passed in Congress, what, last fall sometime?
Mm-hmm.
And it was passed by a Democratic Congress, not by George Bush, who was not president at the time. So it was a big mistake, I think, for Pacifica to attack Bush. They should attack, if they don't like the law itself or whatever it was, attack the law.
Mm-hmm.
But don't use Ayatollah one more time on us. We've all had that, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
And that is panic thinking. It's over-emotionalizing. Let's get down to the root. What's your problem?
Okay. Fair enough. And we are at this point...
Norman, what are you doing now?
I'm listening to Bradbury and enjoying it every minute of it.
We are, we're trying to mug Norman to write his autobiography. But on that note, we are about out of time, and I want to thank our guests for coming tonight, Ray Bradbury and Norman Corwin. In 2 years,
Gallagher and Sheen, we call ourselves.
We've done about 104 shows now on this show.
We have.
We have. Frightening, isn't it?
You bet.
And this, I would say, is probably, if not one of the best. At least the best, or vice versa, perhaps. I went to lunch. I'm sorry. I just...
could have never had that dinner or whatever.
I think so.
Put this on a slow tape, you got 4 hours.
That's what you do anyway. Again, thanks to our guests for coming tonight. Our producers, Terry Hodel and Bert Handelsman, my co-host, Larry DiTilio. Next week, we have Dorothy Fontana joining us.
DC Fontana from Star
right.
Trek,
this,
the old Star Trek.
This program is copyright 89 by Synthetic Worlds Limited. My name is Joe Straczynski, and as always, and until next week, good night, Mike.